Welcome to the Global Leader Podcast, where we discuss all things related to leadership with leaders from around the world. My name is Laura Boyko, and as an experienced leader and coach, I dig deep into leadership issues that our expert consultants from academia, research, and a variety of industries have encountered. I'm a leadership and team development consultant with Global Leadership Initiatives, and I've held leadership positions over the last 15 years in healthcare and education, leading, developing, and transforming over a dozen teams. I love digging deep into how teams work and also how we as leaders can create engaging and supportive work environments. GLI is a Canadian leadership development organization with over 36 world-class expert consultants in leadership, sustainability, management, and team development from countries around the world like Canada, the US, South Africa, Russia, and China. GLI exists to develop excellence in leadership globally, and we do this through the 4I process of inquiry, intervention, impact, and iteration. This 4I approach to leadership development is achieved through the books we write, the courses we develop, the workshops, podcasts, and webinars we deliver. GLI leverages the best of leadership development theory and practice by bringing together a talented pool of highly experienced leadership development experts, researchers, and coaches that will help individuals develop and positively impact organizational processes. For more great content, navigate to our membership website at glimembers.com. I hope you enjoy the following conversation and take away something to enhance your leadership. Good morning. Welcome back to the GLI podcast. This morning with me, I have two esteemed guests that we recently did a webinar with regarding a new book that they have out. Let me introduce you to our two guests this morning. Seth Silver is the principal of Silver Consulting, Inc., which is an independent consulting practice where he worked with over 200 client organizations in healthcare, higher education, high tech, government, business services, manufacturing, and nonprofit. Seth taught as a professor at St. John Fisher College and the Rochester Institute of Technology from 2000 to 2014, and sat on the governance boards of several nonprofit organizations in the Rochester area. His doctorate degree is from the George Washington University. We're very happy to have you with us here today, Seth. So welcome.
Thanks, Laura.
Seth, better you than me, but can you tell our audience a little bit more about your consulting work?
Sure. So the work really is in two distinct areas, and one is around leadership. So whether the person calls themselves a team leader, a supervisor, a manager, a director, an executive, business owner, my role is to help them understand more about leadership. And I like to joke that leadership is a verb, not a title. So I do a lot around leadership, and that includes coaching and training and half-day programs, multi-day programs, etc. The other and related is creating great workplaces. I'm a firm believer that workplaces should be places of dignity, meaning, and community. I love those three words, dignity, meaning, and community. So how do we create engaging, high-performance workplaces where people want to come and give 110%? And obviously those two things are connected. Great leaders create great workplaces, and we hope great workplaces create great leaders.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that dignity piece, because a lot of times people come to work and sometimes can feel like they're just a number or they don't really have a value in the workplace. So I also align with that for your work. Tim, we also have our esteemed guest, Tim Franz, here with us today, and he's an industrial and organizational psychologist at St. John Fisher College. He is a professor and interim chair of the Department of Psychology. Prior to his work as a professor, Dr. Franz, or Tim as we're going to call him today, worked full-time as a human resources consultant. And he also works as an organizational consultant through his consulting organization, Franz Consulting, and also with GLI. So welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me today, Laura.
You're very welcome. Tim, again, better you than me. Can you tell us a little bit about your research expertise? What areas do you focus in?
Well, my specialty is really around leadership development, team development, and doing applied research in organizations. So it's really how can we make things better with leaders in their teams, and then how do we learn about that in an applied situation? So more than just the generic research that college faculty often do. You know, Seth is a consultant who professes, and I'm a professor who consults, and we both have that applied focus in what we do. So my work really, especially in the past 10 years, is very focused on how do we make leaders and teams work better together, and how do we understand with applied research, whether it's focus groups or interviews or surveys or 360 degree feedback? How do we understand what's going on so we can make positive change in the workplace?
Yeah, that's so needed. And I think as we head out of the COVID pandemic, we're going to need to be looking to research such as yours to really understand how do we re-team, how do we reintegrate in workplaces that are now maybe going to be hybrid / in office, work from home. So there's going to be a lot of dynamics that we're definitely going to need to be pulling on your research and your consulting. So I think we've got some interesting things to be discussing here today. Recently, we did a webinar with Seth and Tim, and it was talking about their new book called Meaningful Partnership at Work. And it's a book that they co-authored. And we're looking to bring this concept to a wider audience. And so through the webinar and through today's podcast, we can learn a little bit more about what meaningful partnership is at work and how we can enact that in our workplace. Seth and Tim, there's tons of books out there on leadership and teamwork. You can just Google it on Amazon and you can get 1,452 hits of teamwork and leadership type books. So why this book? Why write a book about meaningful partnerships at work? Seth, you want to start us off?
Sure. Well, the need is acute. It goes back, for me personally, to the work that I was doing at a technology company back in the 1990s. And I had the privilege of working with teams and managers and doing team building, which was quite in vogue at this company at that time. And I would meet with the managers and ask how things were going, and without the team, just the manager. And invariably, I would ask about the relationship and they would give me their wish list. You know, I wish the team would do this. I wish the team would do that. I wish the team would solve problems without bugging me. I wish the teams, you know, would stop chatting with each other during meetings. I wish they were better prepared and more on time and more on budget, et cetera. And then I'd meet with the teams and the teams would express a similar wish list. Without the boss in the room, they would tell me, we wish our boss would give us more recognition, understand our outside lives, provide more resources, fill unfulfilled, unfilled vacancies, et cetera. So these two sets of wish lists occurred to me that they're not having the conversation they need to have, which is about what they need from each other, their mutual expectations. And I could feel the frustration of the team relative to the relationship with their manager. I could feel the pain, if you will, and the frustration of the manager relative to the team. You know, fast forward through 20 plus years of consulting, like Groundhog Day, this kind of repeated. Almost invariably, when I meet with groups in, again, high tech and healthcare and higher education, all the different groups I'm working with, some variation of that same conversation has always happened. You know, the managers would complain about what is not happening with their team or what their team is not doing. And then when I would meet with the team, they would have some issues with their manager. And so it occurred that it's that relationship. It's that space in between. You know, I'm holding my hands up and one hand is a manager and one hand is the team. And it's that space in between that the book is really about. So, you know, I think you sort of prefaced the question with how is this different than a leadership or teamwork book? You know, a lot of leadership books that I have read and have taught and have shared with other people are very prescriptive. You know, here's the 48 things that good leaders do. It's almost a checklist. And to some extent, it's one size fits all. You know, whether you're in government or not for profit or whatever, here's the 48 things you need to do. Our book is not like that. We don't actually say, hey, manager, Mr. or Ms. Manager, this is what you should do. Rather, it's here's the conversation you need to have with your team, exchanging obligations, expectations, and discussing the need for support. How do we support each other? Really listen to your team, please, and then respond to it with the behavior you give them. That will make you a better leader. But we don't come into the book saying, here are the things you have to do to be a better leader. And similarly with the team, there are books about teamwork and Tim's written some great ones. We're not prescribing specifically what teams should do, but rather that they should listen to their manager and understand how best to support their manager. So it's that relationship, it's that space in between that is the focus of the book. Mm-hmm.
The space in between is something I've seen in my own work. And, you know, when you say you've experienced this and heard this over 20 years of in consulting, and I'm sure, Tim, you've also heard similar stories in your applied research. What is it about that space? Why can't we figure out that space? What is it that missing piece in teamwork between management and team workers and team members? Tim, do you got any ideas?
Well, I think one of the biggest thing is that ongoing dialogue that is so important and so necessary, that what Seth talked about, this two-way street of frustration, that the leaders of the team have something that they wish, and the team members have something that they wish. And these things are implicit and never made explicit. And we really need to focus on how to make those implicit wishes explicit, have a safe space, a psychologically safe space, to discuss our expectations of each other and our obligations to one another, so that we all feel supported and are able to succeed. It's not just about the trust fall, which a lot of people, you know, team development processes have a bad name because, yeah, people think about the trust fall. Oh, you're gonna make me feel good. And Seth and I, neither of us does anything like that. When we do team development work, it's about getting people to work on a task together better, not about feeling good about one another. But feeling supported is important. Feeling supported in your work, feeling like somebody has your back, feeling like you know that they're going to meet those commitments that they've said they have, and being successful. We all want to be successful at work. What we know is that so many people leave their job, not because they don't believe in the mission or the values of the organization, but because they're struggling with their immediate supervisor. And so many supervisors, team leaders, managers are struggling with their team members because they don't feel like their team members are doing what they need. And so this idea of meaningful partnership, our concept, really is about trying to get that ongoing dialogue so that the leaders and the teams both have their explicit expectations met and have obligations to one another that can help them be successful.
I'd like to build on what Tim said and say that sometimes they don't know what to ask. They know they're frustrated. The manager and the team have this two-way street of frustration, but they're not exactly sure how to have that conversation. Right. And so what we've articulated is, what are the questions you need to ask each other? Or what are the questions you should ask yourself and provide the answers to the other party? So, you know, partnership, of course, suggests that there's two parties. We focus a lot on the leader and the team because that's the most important relationship at work, you and your boss. However, partnership can exist between two departments, between two individuals, between a board and a senior staff of a nonprofit, subgroups. So between you and your partner, what do you ask? Well, it's that notion of support. How can I support you? You know, what do I need to provide so you feel supported and can be successful? And what do I need from you so I feel supported and can be successful?
Yeah, so that sounds like the meaningful partnership piece. And how does that differ from ordinary collaboration and work environment?
So we define meaningful as above and beyond. We talk about how Ruth Bader Ginsburg led a meaningful life, the Supreme Court justice who dedicated her life to women's rights and the advancement of women in society. And she had impact. There was a legacy. She's referenced. So it wasn't just sort of, I mean, not that any Supreme Court justice is not ordinary or is ordinary, but it went above and beyond. And so we talk about meaningful partnership as an elevated state of cohesion, connection, coordination, and collaboration, the four C's. So it's an elevated state. So we do think of meaningful partnership as above and beyond and having more impact. And really, in our own personal experience, striking us as something that was distinct. I mean, we all collaborate with others in many, many ways at work. The larger the organization, the more collaborations you have. But I would challenge anyone to say, you know, what are the best collaborations you've ever had, the best work partnerships you've ever had? Mm-hmm. And when we have people reflect on that, they come back with, that person or that group had my back. They understood my needs. They listened. We made decisions together. So there is that spirit of partnership that's mm-hmm. above and beyond.
Yeah, that four C's sounds like the cornerstones of a really strong, high functioning team. How do you create these meaningful partnerships in the workplace? How do you get to those four C's in a team? Tim?
Well, in our book, we lay out a mindset, which we've been talking about, a model and a medium. The mindset is meaningful partnership, that elevated sense of cohesion, collaboration, coordination, and connection, the four C's, that really makes both parties accountable for supporting and succeeding one another. So that is our mindset, meaningful partnership. We have a model for how to get to meaningful partnership. It's what we call ERTAP. ERTAP is empathy, respect, trust, alignment, and partnership. And though we put these out in a linear fashion, empathy comes first. Empathy is this profound appreciation for the perspective of others, understanding how they feel and their challenges and what's important to them. And that, if we have empathy, can lead to respect. Respect from us in a work context is when we see another person as a valid and legitimate partner, deserving of the rights that we would expect of ourselves. And that leads to trust. And trust is when we know somebody is going to have our back. We know somebody is going to not speak ill of us. And we know that they're going to have some confidence in our work, or we're going to have confidence in their work. And then that moves us to alignment, putting us on the same track, moving forward together. In the book, Seth and I often use an analogy of two in a canoe, where we're paddling quietly, peacefully together towards a common goal, moving forward in sync. And that's what we want with this alignment, which leads us to partnership and eventually that elevated sense of partnership, the meaningful partnership. Finally, we have a medium. We talk about the workplace covenant. We don't use covenant in a religious sense. We use covenant as a contract that has obligatory weight, a signed commitment to one another. So the workplace covenant is a very stepwise process where a leader and their team get together and make commitments based on those expectations and obligations. So that's how you get to meaningful partnership, is through ERTAP and the workplace covenant.
Okay. How do you know that the process works? I imagine, you know, your applied research, you've tested this out in organizations. Seth, you've gone in and done team building with organizations and put this into practice and used the model and put ERTAP into practice in the four C's. How do you know it works?
So Tim and I collaborated on some research, and we had two studies and small sample sizes of six or seven teams. And we measured the effects on empathy, respect, trust, and alignment, as well as engagement and empowerment and performance. So we saw over time that a team that had a workplace covenant that used it and then did one, two, and three reviews, essentially on a quarterly basis, so used the covenant process over a year, had dramatic effects on their levels of empathy, respect, trust, alignment, and also performance. And conflict also went down, by the way. But I will also say anecdotally, you know, over years of doing this process with, you know, literally hundreds of groups, when you're in the room and you hear the exchange of a manager sharing, you know, here's what I owe you guys so that you'll feel supported and be successful. And here's what I expect from you so I will feel supported and be successful. And the team in turn shares the reciprocal set of questions. There's a level of honesty, there's a level of depth, there's a level of meaningfulness, if I can use that word again, that happens. And you know, and they tell me, they're having conversations they would not have had otherwise. It helps to have a third party structuring it, no question. So that's a helpful safety factor, if you will. Mm-hmm. But the structure itself allows them to exchange these things and talk about them and talk about differences and where their lists do not match and where they need to make some adjustments. And it's particularly powerful when we get to the reviews. We believe that the initial creation of a workplace covenant between two parties is about a 2.5 to 3 hour session. And then these reviews are approximately 90 minutes each, and they should occur quarterly. These are the formal reviews. And in those conversations, you exchange feedback. And it's like, well, here's my covenant to you, and here's how I think I've done on it over the last 3 months. You know, I'll give myself a check mark on these 8 items, but these 2 items I know I screwed up on. So, and you're voluntarily forthcoming in where you believe you haven't been as role model a partner as you could or should have been. And then the other partner does that on themselves. And then you look at the partner's covenant to you and say, okay, you know, here are these 6 things you have done well as my partner, but here's 3 things I'd like you to improve or change. That exchange of feedback becomes very important. because you're making those micro adjustments. My analogy is it's like a pilot who makes micro adjustments of altitude flying in, you know, turbulent weather or something. You move up and down based on the impact and the feedback you get, right, from air traffic control or weather. So I've heard those conversations. I've heard the anecdotal. I know for a fact that teams have talked about how conflict disappeared as a result of this process. Our book, in fact, talks about four particular real case stories, two male managers, two female managers who had respective challenges. And as a result of this process, really improved the climate that they had with their team.
Mm. It sounds like a great tool to be able to bring teams together. In my experience leading and managing several teams, I found that there was a sweet spot. You'd get a team to a really great place. Maybe you were doing, you know, we did work similar to the Covenant without calling it such, but you got this level of trust. You got this level of partnership. You got this level of synergy among the teammates and, you know, everybody was working well together. It was like a well-oiled machine. And I found there was like this time frame that it would last 2 to 3 years. And then people would either leave, you'd get new members to the team, there'd be some sort of fracture in the team dynamics, and then it would all sort of fritter away and you'd have to start all over again. Do you see a place to do these meaningful covenants repeatedly over time with a similar team or in a same organization? Or is this a one and done kind of thing?
Well, as you know, the one and dones, we get really excited as people who work in organizations with teams or groups trying to develop them. We go in and we do some intervention and we're all excited and they're all excited. And then we look back 3 months later and nothing's changed because nobody acts on it. The beauty of the workplace covenant is not just that our research shows that it works, as Seth described, that the longitudinal research that we have shows that it works over a year, but it works in part because of the explicit discussion of the expectations and obligations, but more important, it works because it has ongoing regular feedback associated with it. So every 2 to 3 months, there should be a formal review of the covenant. The first one or two should be, as Seth said earlier, should be facilitated because it provides a psychologically safe space for the team to provide feedback to their boss. But after these conversations have gone on 1, 2, 3, or 4 times, the team can manage that review. In fact, we've had teams that can get together in a meeting once a month, and in 10 minutes, they review their covenant and they give each other direct, honest feedback. Check plus, check minus, a zero, whatever it is, however they do it. Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs in the middle. Very quick feedback on how they're doing. And then the team and the leader have this ongoing opportunity to correct. And so our research shows that this works over time, in part because of the beginning and in part because of these ongoing discussions that help the covenant process to carry a team forward and make it routine.
Mm-hmm. Seth?
So if I can build on Tim's idea here. So, you know, people are a process, not a product. Things will always evolve. And first of all, I think it takes a bit of discipline, a little bit. They have to schedule these quarterly reviews, whether they think there's, you know, real feedback to be exchanged or not. So there is some discipline in setting it in the calendar. And every time they do, they have the conversation and they oh, why were we even thinking of not scheduling this? Because the conversation becomes meaningful. The second is that I think on your covenant promises over the year or 2 years, there will be natural up and downs, right? I mean, people get busy or things happen. And so your ability to fulfill your promises in the covenant can go, you know, up and down on a given period of time. The analogy I like to use is it's like a yo-yo on an upward moving escalator. The escalator is moving up, but the yo-yo will go up and down a little bit, you know, depending on the group and some of the issues. But having that covenant forces you to have the conversation on a routine basis about the relationship. And that's what most teams lack. That's why they get into trouble. And so to your point, you know, does it become stale, or your implied point, does it become stale after a year and a half or 2 years? Yeah, I think you can recreate it. I think when there's significant changes on the team, you recreate it. Certainly if the manager changes. You recreate it for sure. Yeah. You know, if you have a team of 10 people and four people rotate off, that's almost half. I would probably recreate it. Right. So I think the nature of what's in that covenant can get tweaked over time to keep it fresh.
And so you're talking a little bit about a psychologically safe space. Certainly my therapy background, I'm hearing like family systems therapy here. I'm hearing even some sort of couples work where, you know, what are your expectations of me as your partner? What are my expectations of you as a partner? So I'm hearing these pieces of relationship. And I'm wondering, has this worked in your experience? Has this worked better in certain industries or certain types of work other than others? Because I think there's certain people that would be a bit more inclined to expressing expectations of others and sort of people skills. I'm not going to use soft skills. I'd like to say sort of those people skills that are so important associated with emotional intelligence. Tim, do you have any perspectives on that? Does it work better in certain industries?
Well, we've used it across quite a few industries now. It works across industries because it's not industry specific. We really get any team and leader to have these conversations about expectations and obligations. And it's that facilitated conversation that can help. So lately, we've been working in academia, my field. We've got two groups we're working with right now where there were struggles in departments, and we're helping those departments to get realigned and back on track to be working together better. We've used it in high tech. We've used it in manufacturing. And I give Seth credit. He started with a bit of the origin story for this. This is Seth's baby. And I got pulled along probably about 12 or 15 years ago, pulled along for the ride. And I've really appreciated the ride. So this is a meaningful partnership between Seth and me that we've had ongoing for quite a few years. So Seth's used it far more than I have. But yes, it works across industry. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't often we use as the model, the leader and the team. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other situations in which this works. So right now, for example, in these academic departments, we're not only doing a department chair to department covenant, we're also doing a peer-to-peer within the department covenant, which is a slightly different process. And we lay it out in the book so you can learn more about how to do this in depth in our book. Mm-hmm. But it's used in multiple ways. It could be used in a volunteer organization. It could be used as a one unit that works with another unit. We've actually, Seth and I have done that before in a matrix organization where the units have to work together. And of course, when you get these different units working together, there's constant friction between the groups about which things they should prioritize, the internal or external things. And internal, we've gotten those to, that we've gotten those units to have that important conversation and have a covenant between units. So there are lots of different ways it can work. It works in many situations, not always. There have been a couple of times, the rare occasion when it doesn't work. And really, I would say when you have a highly narcissistic leader who really is averse or not open to change. You have to be willing to get feedback and change. Mm-hmm. So if you are the type of person who are, you know, you're completely unwilling to change, this isn't for you. But if you're willing to change, which most people are, this process can work. Mm-hmm. There are also situations where we've seen a person in a team who is resistant to the covenant. And in more than one of those situations, that team member has decided to move along after the covenant process because they weren't a fit for that team. So in most situations, in most industries, this will work.
Okay.
If I can build on Tim's answer to that question. So, you know, the origin story, as we like to call it, where this came from originally, the epiphany, was in an engineering development environment. And so it was engineers, and, you know, as a stereotype, perhaps they're not the most touchy-feely of people. And as the process has evolved over time, with Tim and I doing this together and him sort of suggesting this and I suggest that, and so it's different and evolved and better than it was obviously 20 years ago. We've always kept in mind, how can this, because you mentioned about counseling speak and couples therapy and such. For people who understand that, they'll get it right away. They'll see that behind the words of the questions. They'll see that behind the dialogue. They'll understand there's something of that behind this process. But for the Sheldon Coopers, a la, you know, Big Bang Theory, and for the techie nerds with, you know, let's say on a stereotype level, fewer people skills, they don't have to have them. They just have to answer the questions. You know, what are the obligations I have to my partner? What do I expect from my partner?
Right.
And that's actually very TQM-ish, total quality management. That's very supplier spec and customer requirement. So they can answer those questions on that level. They don't have to be, shall we say, high EQ to take these questions, answer them, and have the conversation with their partner. And so I think that's actually the beauty of this workplace covenant process too, is while EQ helps, it is also intended for those who may not have that so much. And how do they then address the soft side of working in an organization and having important collaborations, but not necessarily having the intuitive instinct to know how that works? The process makes them listen. The process makes them adapt. The process exposes them to feedback.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you guys are both so knowledgeable in this area, both from a research and from a consulting perspective. Writing this book, what did both of you learn about your own work? How did it change or inform or tweak how you do your own work?
Well, I will say one thing is Seth and I have, for the first time, a covenant. We have made explicit, we have a workplace covenant, and it's in my home office. I'd show you the signed on video here, the signed copy of it, but we have a signed covenant. So how has it changed our work? One, it's made me think, and you've talked about the family, your family therapy background, there is a link to how families work. And we're not saying the workplace covenant should be for families because it's the workplace covenant. But when we measured alignment and partnership, we pulled from the marriage and family literature because there was nothing in the organizational literature about that. So our foundation does in part come from that.
Yeah.
But I also think about when I'm talking about this, I don't say it to my family, I have a covenant to you, but I do think about my obligations to my three teens or mm-hmm. young adult, two of them are young adults now, or my obligations to my wife. So really try to think about how that might improve my relationship all around. Mm. Seth?
So how has it affected me? I'm further sensitive to this issue of support. I'll echo what Tim said. The notion of support in key personal relationships. I think from a work standpoint, writing the book refined our ideas. Tim and I have had this discussion several times, you know, with the webinars and podcasts we've done. And, you know, if we could go back, we wouldn't change anything in what's there, but we'd add sections. And so one of the epiphanies we've had is around accountability. In organizations today, they talk a lot about accountability and, you know, who's accountable and such. And we've realized you can't have accountability without clear expectations, clear agreed upon expectations. So if you want to get to accountability, the road to it goes through clear and agreed upon, preferably signed and reviewed often, expectations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one thing that sort of emerged from this. The other is the extent and degree of support, as we've discussed. And the other is just a heightened sensitivity to the quality of relationships that are going on at work. I mean, I think intellectually we knew this at the beginning and, you know, the epiphany 20 something years ago and now writing the book, we knew relationships are important, but it's really put the spotlight on the quality of relationship that you have with colleagues or your boss or your key departments, your key partners is totally going to affect your experience at work and your productivity. I'll give you a quick example. I got a call today, ironically, from one of the real client stories that's in the book. He and I keep in touch and we're friends, and he's actually deciding to change companies at this point. He loves his work. He loves his colleagues. He doesn't like his current boss. And he's moving to a different opportunity because his best boss in the world is at this other organization. And after 16 years, he's leaving this company. So relationship is everything for him. You know, he's leaving good work and good pay and good colleague relationships to get a better boss and to have more, you know, more freedom. So, you know, how has it affected me? I think I'm just incredibly sensitive and focused laser-like on the quality of relationships that people have.
Mm-hmm. And those relationships exist in so many facets of our life. And as you were talking, Tim, a little bit about, you know, the theories that you were pulling from, family systems theory and whatnot. I actually think I used your covenant without knowing I was using it. A few years ago, I was helping out with my daughter's hockey team, and we were having some dynamic issues on the team with the girls and some gossip in the dressing room and whatnot. And we actually pulled them into the dressing room one night, and we did a covenant in the dressing room about expectations from each other, both the coach and the players. I wrote it out, printed it, laminated it. We put it up in the dressing room during practices. Like it was a thing. And, you know, you need those expectations and you need to be accountable to each other, whether it's, you know, winning games, meeting metrics, KPIs. A team does need to know what are the expectations of me and then how am I accountable to that. So I think your covenant is actually being used around the world and in different workplaces without people knowing that it's actually what they're doing. I have a question in terms of like how do we use meaningful partnerships or how would people use your book if they were to pick it up if they don't actually have a team to lead right now? Is there something in the book that people can learn, say, I want to be a leader in the future. I hope to lead teams in the future. I'd like to use this covenant for my own work in the future. What would you say to someone who's not currently leading a team?
I think it can be effective for anybody. In fact, when we do some presentations about the workplace covenant, we tell people to talk about a key work partnership, a key client, a key person they work with internally. So a lot of the concepts, again, the core is the leader in the team, but we lay out in the book how this can be used in several different types of relationships. It's a stepwise procedure. As Seth said earlier, it provides a number of steps, and we lay these out in the book, where you can follow these steps and use it as a guide to create this. And it does work. Seth and I got an email yesterday from one of our clients, and let me read you very briefly this. The best part for me was learning about the covenant. It's a template for leaders. My suggestion is that every manager should create and execute a covenant with their team, and it should be a KPI in an organization. And every branch at this organization should do it because it's worth every minute. So it can be used in a lot of different situations.
That's an excellent testimonial. I don't think I could have said it better myself. As we close in here on our time together today, I'm curious to know, maybe Seth, what was the one big idea or takeaway that you hope people get from the book or the workplace covenant process?
There are a couple. The notion of that partnership is important, that it has an impact, that the benefits are enormous. They're positive to the culture, creating this psychologically safe place and a forum in which we can exchange praise and feedback with each other safely. It makes better leaders. It makes teams that are able to self-review and self-assess and make adjustments. So the benefits are huge. It's this notion of meaningful partnership, that we should set higher standards, that average collaborations aren't good enough. They're not good enough for today's youth who are looking for significance in their work. It's not good enough for people who are working virtually and from home and who need to feel a greater sense of connection with their colleagues, post-pandemic or current pandemic, depending where you are. This isolation and anxiety has really taken over. So we have to step up our expectations, no pun intended, around our collaborations with each other. And ultimately, we want to avoid, we call it the four Ds, dissatisfaction, disengagement, despair, and departure. We want to avoid the negative things that happen in a lot of workplaces. And so our antidote, our vaccine, if you want to use something current, is meaningful partnership. That's our vaccine.
Okay.
And the process, if you will, is the injection. The workplace covenant is kind of like that injection. And I think when you've got that vaccine, when you've got that level of protection, you're having those conversations, you're having that new level of standard in terms of what a great relationship should be between a manager and a team, you take the organization and you take the experience of work to a whole new level. I started with dignity, meaning, and community. You want to get there? Inoculate yourself. Yes. With the notion of meaningful partnership and the workplace covenant that supports it.
That's a great analogy. Thanks, Seth. Tim, one big takeaway that you would want people to get from the book?
That everybody could use this. It's not something that's really hard to figure out. As I said, we lay out the process. We give the process away inside the book. We want everybody to help their organizations get better by creating meaningful partnerships. So to me, this is something you can do. It's not something that you need, here we are, two college professor consultants with doctoral degrees, but it's not something you need a doctoral degree to do. It is a simple stepwise process that everybody could use to improve their relationships at work.
That's fantastic. I think this is something that hopefully the word gets out about meaningful partnerships as we head out of the COVID pandemic and back into our workplaces, whatever they may be. Hopefully we're inoculated as a new team. And I just want to say thank you to both of you, to Dr. Timothy Franz and Dr. Seth Silver, for joining us today on the GLI podcast. If you want to hear more about the things that GLI is up to, please visit us at globalleader.ca. If you'd like to become a member with GLI, visit glimembers.com, where you can receive free coaching, free books, access to webinars and podcasts just like this, and learn more from global leaders around the world. Until next time, thanks very much, and we'll see you again.